Hello and welcome to the IEA podcast, the episode you're about to listen to, an IEA book club event with broadcaster and journalist Ian Dale, was originally recorded as a YouTube live stream with participants on Zoom. If you would like to find out how to join these events in future, visit the IEA website, iea.org.uk, where you can find out how to join our book club.
We are here to discuss Ian Dale's latest book, The Prime Ministers. The foreword's written by the present Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who noted many of my predecessors were giants. Some had feet of clay, all possessed human foibles. For each of the 55 Prime Ministers that we have had, a different author, perhaps an historian, an academic, a journalist, a private secretary, a speechwriter, some other politician has written an essay about them. Biographers include Edward Young on Disraeli, Jack Brown on Balfour, Andrew Adonis on Tony Blair, David Campbell Bannerman on Henry Campbell Bannerman. And Ian Dale has brought all of this together in one amazing tome, which you can buy for just a little over £17 on YouTube for the proper tactile hard copy. Or if you're one of these newfangled people, it's about a tenner to get it on Kindle. So it's difficult looking at the role of Prime Minister to think of another role which has become so powerful and hankered over, yet for the first 100 years or so of its existence, following the creation of the role, the title was routinely denied or shunned by those supposedly holding it. George Grenville described Prime Minister as an odious title. Lord North said he would never suffer himself to be called Prime Minister, despite which the role has unquestionably grown to become the summit of British politics, the ultimate ambition of so many parliamentarians. What's it take to climb to the top of the greasy pole? And what do we make of the people who got there? Well, the overall editor of this book, I'm delighted to be joined by Ian Dale. Ian, welcome to you. Thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Well, thanks for
inviting me. Ian will be well known to all of you, presenter on LBC, for which he won Radio Presenter of the Year in 2013 and 2016, broadcaster, commentator, blogger, podcaster, author. I thought, Ian, I'd read most of your books, but it says here you've now edited or written more than 40 books. I hadn't even read half of them, I don't think. But your previous titles include The NHS, Things That Need to Be Said, Prime Minister Boris and Other Things That Never Happened. And earlier this year, which we might talk about a little at the end, Why Can't We All Just Get Along? Until 2018, Ian was managing director of Britain's leading political publisher, Biteback Publishing. In his spare time, if he has any, he's also a visiting professor of politics and broadcasting at the University of East Anglia. Ian, I'm amazed you find any time at all to be a West Ham United fan. Thanks very much indeed for joining us today. Great pleasure to have you with us, Ian.
Thank you.
Tell us about this book. What's it say? What can we learn from it? Why should we buy it?
Well, the reason that I compiled it was because I realised that in 2021, it's the 300th anniversary of Sir Robert Walpole becoming Prime Minister. And he is, by common consent, Britain's first Prime Minister. There were people who you could have described as that before that, but no one did. There were lots of First Lords of the Treasury. And Walpole considered himself to be First Lord of the Treasury, and he regarded being called Prime Minister, which really happened towards the latter stages of his premiership, he regarded it as an insult because he thought, well, I am merely first among equals around the cabinet table. But as we've seen over the last 300 years, the Prime Minister is not an equal and increasingly not an equal to the rest of the cabinet. Power has centralised in number 10 in a way that would have been unthinkable in the 18th and 19th centuries, and indeed for most of the 20th century, I suspect. So the Prime Minister is master of all he or she surveys, or ought to be, but it still does depend on what kind of parliamentary majority you have, as Theresa May found out. She was certainly not mistress of all she surveyed. So when I worked out that was the anniversary, it was about, towards the end of 2018, I thought, well, there's no way that I can write an essay on each of these prime ministers. So I thought, well, I know enough people to get them to get a collection together. So as you say, it is a mixture of people. Some of them I asked to do specific prime ministers. Others I said, well, which one would you like to do? And it's a pretty eclectic mix of people. You've got Simon Heffer writing on Gladstone, which I personally think is one of the best essays in the whole book. I learned so much about Gladstone from that. And the one thing that you realise when you read the essays, particularly of one of prime ministers, say, from the late 19th, early 20th century, you realise how little you know about them. And I've discovered so much reading the essays, from particularly the early ones, where I'd never heard of the Earl of Shelburne, for example. And I suspect many people watching now that there will be some prime ministers. Henry Pelham, who succeeded Walpole in 1742, he was prime minister for 9 years. Well, I think I'd vaguely heard of him, but he hadn't really come across my radar. So it's a book that you can dip into. I mean, it's 560 pages, so I would not describe it as a loo book. But in a way it is, because it's not, I doubt whether many people will start at the beginning and just read it sequentially. You probably dip into the ones that you might be interested in.
Well, that's fascinating. And so I can immediately see that this is going to help on pub quizzes, right? If you dip into this book, you know, when the pub quiz question came up, who succeeded Walpole and how long was he prime
Don't
minister
test
for?
Me, please.
I'm not going to test you. I'm intrigued what you said, without giving it all away, because we want people to buy the book, obviously. Other than, ooh, I barely heard of this one, or I barely heard of that one. What were the big revelations? Because I kind of rather arrogantly assume that I know a great deal about Gladstone and Disraeli. I'm not an historian by training, but I would consider myself familiar with them. Certainly the prime ministers from Attlee onwards, I could probably run through and give a sort of potted, you know, paragraph or so on what they achieved, even if they were in power long before I was born. What were the bits that that you really learnt, you know, whether it was a loo book or not, that you really surprised you? You mentioned particularly Heffer on Gladstone.
Well, I think it's actually the essay on Disraeli that most surprised me in many ways. Edward Young had written a biography of Disraeli, I think, with Douglas Hurd. And any conservative regards Disraeli as almost the father of the modern conservatism. This essay rather questions that, and even questions whether he really came up with the one nation phrase. So it's sort of Disraeli sceptical in a way, and portrays Disraeli as a pretty mediocre character in some ways. So there are some of the essays that surprise you as to what you learn from others. Look, most people who wrote the essays in this book, they're either experts on the subject, or they are fans of that particular prime minister. So you do have to bear that in mind sometimes. I mean, Rachel Reeves, for example, the Shadow Cabinet Minister, she is clearly a fan of Harold Wilson, although she writes it in a way which slightly disguises that, but she can see his errors as well. Andrew Adonis, who we all think of as a Tony Blair fanboy, and there are aspects to his essay which are a bit fanboyish, but a lot of it is being very realistic. And I did encourage them to bring themselves into it. If they had a relationship with the politician that they're writing about, well, feel free to write about that. But in terms of revelations, I'm not sure there are any great revelations. I think it helped me understand what makes a good prime minister and what makes a bad prime minister. I think that was probably the lesson that I derived from the whole thing. It gave me a bit of clarity of thought on that.
Well, great. Share with us. I mean, you should abandon your broadcasting career and immediately take on Dom Cummings' job at number 10 then. what is the distinction? Because and we'll come a bit to some of your rankings in a moment, but what is the distinction there? What makes someone a successful or a good prime minister or a poor one?
I mean, there are all sorts of things, but I think one thing is, can you describe the prime minister as transformational? And if you look down this list of the 55, and particularly in the rankings that we've done, if you look at the top 10, they are virtually all people that you would describe as transformational people. Obviously, Margaret Thatcher, we don't need to dwell on her. We all know about the transformation that she brought in. You look at Gladstone, you look at Disraeli to an extent as well. You look at Clement Attlee. A lot of people think that Clement Attlee should be in the top three or four. Now, he wasn't prime minister for that long. It was only 6 years. But when he came to power after the war, people expected a lot of that government, and he delivered that. Now, you and I might question some of the policies and state control and all the rest of it, but no one can deny that he transformed the face of the economy and the country. So I think he does deserve a fairly high ranking. Does Tony Blair deserve that ranking? In some ways, he transformed the Labour Party. Did he transform the country? I think we could have a very, very long debate about that. But he's another one where most prime ministers are remembered for one thing. You go down almost the whole list and there's one thing which people, if they've got a little bit of knowledge of their period of office, they will say Thatcher, the Falklands. I mean, there are several others you could say with her. Clement Attlee, nationalisation. Winston Churchill winning the Second World War. Theresa May failing to get Brexit done. David Cameron. His is a little bit more difficult, but probably the Brexit referendum, I would say, was his. Now, will Boris be remembered for COVID or will he be remembered for getting Brexit done? I suspect the former. He would hope for the latter. So transformational abilities, I think, is absolutely a prerequisite to being. It's what Tony Benn used to describe as, are you a signpost or a weather vane? You have to be a weather vane, I think, to be called a great prime minister.
But this is intriguing because how much of this depends on the personality, the charisma, the intelligence of the prime minister? How much of it just depends on circumstances? I mean, some of those that you've picked out, Ian, well, the circumstances are such that we kind of needed transformation. I mean, Churchill faces the existential threat to the world by the Nazis. Clement Attlee inherits a country that's been bombed to oblivion. Perhaps at other times, you mentioned Tony Blair, well, we didn't need much transformation. We just needed a steady hand on the tiller. You know, it'd be nice if you could keep economic growth ticking along nicely. Be good if you could sort of dial down the crime rate a bit and see wages growing a bit. But we're not really asking much more of you. There isn't an existential threat. I mean, is that the sort of luck of the draw or is it a choice for a prime minister whether they become transformative or not? Or is it just in the background?
You know? It's all of the things that you mentioned. Luck, I think, does play an important role here. Timing. You need to be in the right place at the right time and have the right personality to be able to cope with all the issues that are thrown at you. And you could argue, well, Margaret Thatcher was absolutely the right politician for her time. James Callaghan, on the other, who in theory had all of the attributes to be quite a good prime minister, but he was dealt an appalling hand in terms of the economic legacy that he inherited from Harold Wilson and indeed Ted Heath. And he suffered because of that. He had a cabinet full of very talented people. He was actually very good at managing them. And party management is one talent that you do need to have to be a good prime minister. John Major. I mean, actually, I think history is going to be kinder to John Major than people are at the moment, because even if you take Black Wednesday out of the equation and all of the internecine warfare and the Tory party over Maastricht, if you look at how the economy recovered from that, it's actually quite a good record. Right place at the right time, very important. But that is the same for any political career. When I fought North Norfolk in 2005, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. If I'd fought it in 2019, I would have won. Simple as that. So luck does play a role here. But and the circumstances as well. Asquith, for example, I think would probably have gone down as one of our great prime ministers had the First World War not happened. But he was not the right person to lead us through the war. And obviously Lloyd George took over in 2016, and the rest is history. Now, we sort of remember Asquith also as the father of the welfare state in many ways, but Lloyd George gets the credit for it because he was the brazen one that went out and took the credit. One thing I learned from the book, though, it was actually Henry Campbell Bannerman that really brought in a lot of these measures. And he obviously Asquith took over from him. Yep. But most of the welfare state things that happened in the Asquith Lloyd George era really had their antecedents in Henry Campbell Bannerman's premiership. And I certainly didn't know that. So it's things like that you find out when you look a little bit more deeply.
Really interesting. Let's just sort of get in our TARDIS and go right back to the beginning, Walpole and then Pelham. And I can't remember who the third is. You'll have that front of mind. Don't worry, I'm not going to give you lots of pub quiz questions. Well, how does the role emerge? As I was saying in my opening remarks, it was sort of shunned to some degree. It was, I mean, there's no way we could now call it primus inter pares and first among equals. It's clearly not among equals. Why is Walpole considered to be the first prime minister? You say claims can be made of others, but what changes, what brings this role into being rather than it being a more kind of collegiate association of a bunch of ministers?
Length of tenure, it's as simple as that. He was there for 21 years. Mm-hmm. And the longer you're there as a prime minister, inevitably your power increases. And it's, do you know what to do with that power to make it work for you? Or do you become some quasi-dictatorial figure? Now, Margaret Thatcher was in power for 11 years. And people can have all sorts of views about her dictatorial tendencies, which I think have been hugely exaggerated, actually. If you talk to people who sat around the cabinet table in her time, she actually rather quite liked a good old argument and certainly liked good arguments one-to-one. That was how John Major came to her notice when he stood up to her in a meeting. And I think that was really the reason that the term was invented for Walpole, because he was such a dominant figure. Now, I said earlier he was succeeded by Henry Pelham. He was actually succeeded by the Earl of Wilmington, but for a very short time. And then came Henry Pelham for 9 years. And again, I mean, 9 years is a pretty good length for any prime minister. Lord North served for a good time too, about 30 or 40 years later. Now, he's only remembered for losing the colonies. But you might think, well, he ought to be placed 55th in the list of vying with Anthony Eden to be our worst prime minister. But if you look at his domestic record, and Nicky Morgan wrote the essay on him, if you look at his domestic record, it wasn't actually half bad. So how do you balance that against the fact that it was a completely disastrous time in terms of losing the colonies? This is the wonderful thing about comparing prime ministers. It is all a matter of opinion. There is no science to it. It is what one person will draw up one list of 55 and another a different one. And of course, remember how it's so difficult to compare a prime minister like George Grenville or Robert Walpole or Lord North with John Major or Theresa May or Winston Churchill. They operated at very different times. And even in the last few generations, the job has changed so much to the extent that I don't think Clement Attlee could become prime minister nowadays, because he hated anything to do with the media. You look at some of the interviews that he gave and they were just excruciating for him and indeed the viewer. And you have to have that ability now to connect with people, not just through the mainstream media, but on the internet as well. And so there are politicians in Parliament now that you think, well, it's a good job you weren't being elected now, because because you probably wouldn't even get selected, because that is far more important than the ability to make a public speech.
That's fascinating. So the criteria that you need in order to get the top job have changed enormously, right? I mean, modern media is a reflection of that. You've got to be witty and give a soundbite. I mean, back in the day, you had to be able to give a brilliant 1 hour lecture to a crowd live. Very different skill to being, good and pithy on Newsnight or whatever. But how has the role changed? I mean, we now see the prime minister as the leader of the country. Have we seen this role grow in importance and change in terms of the criteria of the people who are likely to fill it, because the executive has become over the last couple of centuries far more powerful and the legislature far less so? If you go back to the days of Walpole or Pelham, I mean, political parties are incredibly amorphous. You know, you've got tribes, but it's not clear where one ends.
Well, they
and
were factions more than political parties, weren't they? Sure. And modern day political parties, and again, this is something that I'm not sure I knew much of the history of, but the current political parties, or certainly the Conservatives and the Liberals, really emerged from the Corn Law repeals in the 1840s. And one of the things, Nigel Fletcher's essay on the Earl of Derby, I think, is a really important one, because it was he that was the father of the modern Conservative Party, not Disraeli. And he was leader of the Conservative Party for 22 years and played a huge role. And I think a pretty much ignored role by modern day standards. So I think parties have developed in a way that has that they've gone from factions to tribes to organized political parties. There was no real organization before the time of the Earl of Derby and Disraeli, and then the whole Primrose thing with Disraeli. And the Whigs then transformed into the Liberals through the period of Lord John Russell and then Gladstone. And you're right, the art of speech making in those days, I mean, Gladstone would make speeches to 10,000 people. I've often wondered how on earth he made himself heard, because they didn't have microphones, but apparently word was transferred from the front of it. They sort of almost whispered it around the crowds. But he would attract massive crowds in his time. So the job of Prime Minister has changed hugely, in that up until fairly recently, I think a good Prime Minister would have a broad overview of what his government was doing. Whereas nowadays, I think one of the risks that Prime Ministers run is to become too involved in the detail, and they lose complete perspective and think they have to control everything. We've seen that happen under Theresa May and, I'm afraid, under Boris Johnson, where it's not necessarily him, but the number 10 operation seeks to control everything. Now, that didn't happen, it started to happen, I think, under Harold Wilson, probably, maybe before that. But over time, it has become so important for the centre to control everything. And when you have a Conservative Party that preaches the values of localism and subsidiarity and governing from the lowest level, it is slightly ironic that a junior minister nowadays is not allowed to make a speech, even within their own area of competence, without the permission from number 10 Downing Street. Now, a strong prime minister wouldn't really allow that to happen. A strong prime minister would let a thousand flowers bloom. In a way, like Boris did when he was mayor of London, but I'm afraid that the personalities that he's had around him, certainly in his first 18 months, that may now change, has meant that things have become so centralised, just as they did with Theresa May, with Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, and Gordon Brown as well. Everything was run from number 10 in his government. No one could move without Gordon Brown sort of validating it. And that means that you become a weak prime minister, because the civil service actually like a prime minister who can make decisions. And Gordon Brown, I'm afraid, was a procrastinator, and they could never get a decision out of him.
This is really fascinating, though. Do you think that we were mentioning the party system. Do you think this is because of the way the party system has become much more clearly defined? As you're saying, back in the day, you'd have factions. The Conservative Prime Minister would have to be thinking, well, you know, what are Joe Chamberlain's lot going to make of this? Or the Ultras going to make of that? Or, you know, my people in the House of Lords might have a very different feeling to my people in the House of Commons. Now, I mean, I wouldn't go quite this far, but you could make a case that Parliament's basically become a bit like the American Electoral College. You know, you've got people there who are under one ticket or another. Once the Conservatives, the last election, win a majority of 80, it sort of assumed, now the Prime Minister can do whatever the hell he wants, because you could have 30 faithless electors, whereas Theresa May was trying to deal with a hung Parliament. Is it because we basically castrated the legislature? They're party hacks. So all of the real decisions can then be taken by the executive. Well, people are just there to keep them in place, aren't they?
You say that, but Phil Cowley wrote a really good book quite some time ago called Revolts and Rebellions. And his conclusion was that politicians nowadays are far more rebellious than they were 20 or 30 years ago. We've got this idea that MPs are sheep. And I mean, it's not on some issues, they are. You are elected under a party banner, so you do have an obligation to obey the party whip most of the time. But on big issues, look at the Iraq war, for example, and the number of Labour MPs that rebelled on that. You look at all of the Brexit things, and it's quite difficult to categorise people now just as purely right or left as well. It's right and left aren't actually very important words in politics anymore. You can be right wing I mean, you and I suppose, might be quite good examples of this, where we might both be quite right-wing on economic things, but on social issues, well, I'll speak for myself, or you can speak for yourself, on
very
social
liberal,
issues,
yeah.
I'm as wet as a lettuce. On immigration, people would regard me as being on the left, but I would still self-identify as being on the Thatcherite right. But over time, on social issues, I think the agenda has moved on way beyond what it was when I first started being interested in politics.
Yeah, I've got some very, very dangerous left-wing opinions as well, Ian, as well. I'm never badged a left-winger.
It's remarkable that you're still in that job, isn't it?
No, I'm very sceptical. I'm very pro-immigration. I'd end the war on drugs. I'm highly sceptical about Trident, which would be considered to put me in with Jeremy Corbyn and others. The other thing that's changed, presumably, and perhaps you can say a bit more about this, comparing our more modern prime ministers with the earlier iterations in the role, is power's become centralised, but you're also now got a massive machine of advisors around you, right? I mean, who was the equivalent of Dom Cummings to Gladstone or whatever? I mean,
well, Gladstone did have one, funnily enough.
Okay, have I picked a bad example? Well,
no,
or were there equivalents?
Well, look, every politician, whether they're prime minister or not, has a group of confidants, people that they trust, who they and they trust their advice as well, whether they take it or not. You're right that the role of advisors has increased dramatically. I would say, again, since the days of Harold Wilson. But let's not think that previous prime ministers didn't have these people. I can't remember the name of the guy that Gladstone had. He was actually a civil servant, I think. But he took on the role of sort of eminence grise of Gladstone. And as soon as Gladstone stepped down in 1894, after four different terms as prime minister, the Earl of Rosebery took over. And the first thing he did was get rid of this guy,
right?
Because he just thought, well, I'm not going to be able to operate if I have him in the background all the time. Harold Wilson had all sorts of advisors around him.
Famous kitchen cabinet, wasn't it called?
Had Marcia Faulkender, Bernard Donoghue, Joe Haynes, Lord Kagan, remember him, Mr. Gannex, mm-hmm. or Lord mm-hmm. Gannex. And Callaghan had Tom McNally, Bernard Donoghue again. And then, of course, it changed with Margaret Thatcher, and that she changed. There had been a policy unit of sorts in Downing Street before that, but she brought in a lot of more political people. Sir John Hoskins headed it up, and then John Redwood. And it became much more political, and it really developed radical policies that she then adopted in future manifestos. But she had Bernard Ingham and Charles Powell as her two main advisors, and they were there, I think, more or less, right? Well, Bernard Ingham, I think, came in after a year, not quite sure when Powell started, but they were both there for the duration, and she relied on them heavily mm-hmm. to much controversy. You look at Tony Blair, obviously. Alastair Campbell took on, he was almost deputy prime minister, many people would say. Now, I don't see any great problem in that, because I think everyone has to have people that they can confide in and trust, because politics can be a very, very lonely business. And I think that's what Theresa May found. Once Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill were dumped after the 2017 election, I think she felt completely listless. She brought in Gavin Barwell, who had been a Conservative MP, but I don't think those two ever developed the kind of close relationship that Tony Blair and Alastair Campbell had, for example, and Robbie Gibbon the same.
But do you think there's a difference here between what the functionaries or the advisors do that you can imagine? Obviously, this would have changed radically over periods of time, but you can imagine the press officer role being, right, you know, I want to say this, but, you know, what's the best way of getting it across so we get a good write-up in the Times or the London Gazette or on Sky News or on LBC? That's a kind of functionary role. How much do you think prime ministers are increasingly reliant on advisers to tell them what to think and believe? I mean, that's a rather different approach. I mean, certainly with Boris and Dom Cummings, it's almost as if the other way, I mean, some criticism would be there, but the other way around. You know, Boris would be the showman and the spin doctor and the presenter, and I've got just the right punchline to explain this in a speech. But sort of, what does the government believe? What's its philosophy? What's it going to do? Seem to be more in the hands of the special advisors, and the leading politician have become the showman or the presenter. Or am I being unfair?
I think it's always been thus. If you look, I mean, Margaret Thatcher was not a fully formed politician when she became leader of the Conservatives. Conservative Party, it was organisations like the IEA that formed her opinions for her. Mm-hmm. You've got to be knocking at an open door. And I think sometimes some party leaders are more receptive to new ideas than others. I'm trying to think of a politician that came to power with fully formed political views. Gordon Brown probably did. I don't think Tony Blair did by any stretch of the imagination. Sure. Theresa May, I still don't really know what Theresa May believed in. I'm not sure I know fully what Boris Johnson believes in, because you could argue, the left like to argue that he's an extreme right-wing hardliner. Yet if you actually look at his record and a lot of the things that he's said, which weren't sort of ridiculous soundbites that people take out of context, you could argue that he's probably the most liberal One Nation Tory Prime Minister probably since Ted Heath in some ways. But he struggles to get that across, and all of the Brexit debates, I think, didn't help in that regard, because he had to appear something that actually he wasn't, mm-hmm. and that everything was going to be sacrificed in the cause of getting Brexit done. Now, I happen to think that probably was the right approach. But when you start proroguing Parliament illegally, I mean, that I suspect that he was very, very uncomfortable about that, but felt it had to be done just to put a line in the sand.
Interesting. I'm going to come. We've got a whole swathe of questions that have been piling in, so I've been abusing my power as the chair for the last half hour. So let me come to some of the questions. Some of them are anonymous, others have put their names to them. The one that's been the most upvoted is, whose legacy is the most overrated? And I guess I should add as an addendum to that, Ian, what was your top of the pops list? Who wins the league? Who's in the Champions League? And who's in the relegation zone over these 55? That's quite a big league. I guess it's the Premier League plus the Championship plus a bit more if you're ranking them all from top to bottom.
Yeah. It's so difficult to say. It's actually a really good question. One I haven't thought of. Who's the most overrated? You could argue that Lloyd George was overrated, in that most of his domestic achievements came when he wasn't Prime Minister, when he was Chancellor. And yes, he did preside over the victory in the Second World War, but he was only there for the last 18 months, 2 years. In terms of the post-war period, 1919 to 1922, when obviously the 1922 committee had their say, he was a signatory to the Treaty of Versailles, one of the leading lights in that. Well, that wasn't an unalloyed success, if you believe that led in part to the rise of Hitler. So you could make that argument if you wanted. Now, going to the rankings list, the biggest problem in doing this was, how do you compare a 18th century prime minister with a 21st century yeah. prime minister? And the answer is you can't. That there are sort of core things which you can score each on: domestic policy, foreign policy, military, whatever. So the only way I thought of doing it was to try and create so many different ways of scoring them that in the end, what was relevant in the 19th century wouldn't be relevant now, but they would score higher on that than, for example, the ability to deal with the media. Yep. So believe it or not, I came up with 60 different categories. Wow. Where the authors of the essays had to score them, and they were either marks out of 10, 20, 30, 40 or 50, and all added up to 1,000 points. Now, clearly, if you're writing about somebody, you probably have a reasonably high opinion of them. So we had to try and weight it as well to get those sorts of things out of the equation. Also, length of tenure, that has to count as well. But just because you're in office for a long time doesn't mean to say that you're a great prime minister. The Earl of Liverpool, for example, who was the longest serving prime
27
minister.
27 years or something, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah, no, it was 15. It was 1812, I think, to 1827.
Oh, no, you're right, because I remember there was some thought that Margaret Thatcher might beat that record.
Yeah.
She would have needed to have won a fourth term. Yeah.
Well, there's a book coming out later this month called The Lord Liverpool, Britain's Greatest Ever Prime Minister. Well, if you read Peter Riddle's essay in the book on Lord Liverpool, you wouldn't make him even in the top 10. In fact, in this list, he is, where is he? He's kind of the Southampton Football Club of prime ministers.
What, doing surprisingly brilliantly at the moment? Hovering above the mid-table mediocrity.
Well, he's 20th, which is sort of in the Premier League relegation. So, but people will have very different opinions over... he did preside over Catholic emancipation. No, that was the Duke of Wellington. Now, I got into trouble recently because I said I didn't think the Duke of Wellington was a transformational prime minister. And Someone said, yeah, but he presided over Catholic emancipation. So, and I thought, yeah, he did, or certainly the first stages of it. But can you think of many other things that he did as prime minister? And the answer is, well, not a lot. So we created these 60 categories. They were all scored. And then I got five people together and we then... messed around with the rankings a bit. And I mean,
like the A-level exams, right? You sort of second guessed on the basis of what was predicted and then changed the results a little.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, the top 10 is not a surprise. You've got Churchill, Gladstone, Pitt the Younger, Thatcher, Attlee, Lloyd George, Asquith, Disraeli, Salisbury and Walpole. But then just bubbling under, you've got Baldwin, Peel, Earl Grey. Now, he was only Prime Minister for 3 years, but he presided over quite a lot. The 1832 Great Reform Act and the abolition of slavery. I think that probably enables him to claim. And then Blair, Wilson, the Earl of Derby, Viscount Palmerston, Lord John Russell, Henry Pelham, and the Earl of Liverpool, they make up the top 20. But equally, it was quite difficult to decide who should be right at the bottom of the list, because you've got several prime ministers that were only there for a couple of months. George Canning, for example. Yeah. Viscount Goderich, who I must admit was a new one on me. The Duke of Devonshire wasn't there for very long. The Earl of Wilmington. So you can't really put them higher than the bottom four. But then again, people think of Anthony Eden as our worst ever prime minister. Should he be below them? He was prime minister for a couple of years, but presided over Syria. So he's 51st in the list. Right. Theresa May, I'm afraid, only makes 50, just above Anthony Eden.
Boris, she's the West Ham United of the prime minister list, then, isn't it?
Anyway, that's all we've got time for, ladies and gentlemen. Now, where to put Boris? I wrote the essay on Boris, which was actually quite a difficult task, because how do you judge someone's premiership when it isn't over yet? And I really did think while I was writing it, should we even include Boris in this book? But then I thought, well, it's copping out a bit if you don't. So I did include him, and he at the moment is 45th in the list.
Oh, wow. Okay, quite low. I want to try. We've got loads of questions coming in, so let me take. I've asked way too many myself. Let me take some, but I also want to give a free market spin to some of these. David Landsman asks, can you, from the subjects of your book, conceive any circumstances in which a modern prime minister could operate as a primus inter pares and be successful? Or do you now need to be the great sort of leader? Or can you really be the first among equals and be successful in the modern age? Was that something that was required to be successful back in the day, but not so much now?
I think you can be successful doing that. You could argue, look, John Major lost in 1997 to a terrible defeat. But as Jim Callaghan once said, well, there are times when the tide turns and there's nothing anyone can do about it. I still think that John Major, I mean, he ranks 28th in the list, just above David Cameron. I would still put him down as somebody who was overall more positive the negative, which a lot of people watching this might question. But what I also found is that generally, and this is certainly the case since the Second World War, if you have a charismatic prime minister, somebody who would be regarded as a sort of fairly dominant figure, they are always followed by a dull prime minister, and then you get another charismatic one, and then you get another dull one. And that works with American presidents as well. You go back in history and it goes from one to the other. So our next prime minister could be somebody who people might think of as a bit dull, but actually would go back to the kind of cabinet government that traditionally we've had in this country. Now, would that be Rishi Sunak? I don't think we know enough about him to know whether he's charismatic or dull yet. I think he's probably a bit of a mix. Mm-hmm. Keir Starmer, I think, is very charismatically challenged. But it may be in 2024 that if Boris is still prime minister by then, it could be that the country has had enough of charisma and they want a steady hand at the tiller. And whatever you think of his policies and some of the people in his shadow cabinet, he exudes a bit of Attlee, doesn't he, if you think about mm-hmm, it? Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Interesting. David Middleton, former chairman of the IEA Board of Trustees, asks, I regard Robert Peel as our greatest prime minister, but his name hasn't been mentioned. Why is that? Also, some people regard Peel as the kind of founder of both the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party in different ways, yes. Or the Tamworth Manifesto as being the first kind of manifestation of conservative thinking. Where do you put Peel in the list?
Peel is number 12. I think there is an argument that he could be a little bit higher than that. He is a prime minister that I must admit I didn't know an awful lot about before I started writing the book. I knew the basics, but that was about before I started editing the book, not writing it. I knew the basics, but I think you're right. I probably didn't really understand the influence that he had over the formation of the modern Conservative Party. And I mean, he was portrayed, I don't know how many of you watched the Victoria series on ITV. He wasn't portrayed very well in that, I thought, given what I now know about him. So I think, yes, that is a fair point, that he probably does deserve a bit more recognition than he's had.
Okay, and now here's an interesting one. This will be presumably something that we'll never go back to, but Christopher Marshall asks, could Ian comment on prime ministers who were lords? How has the role of the House of Lords changed? I mean, it would be technically constitutional for that still to prevail, but almost unimaginable now that we could have a prime minister in the House of Lords. Was there any meaningful difference about which chamber you were in? I mean, now obviously we're picking one person out of 650 rather than potentially out of both chambers. Are there any features that peers of the realm had as prime ministers distinct from elected politicians?
One thing I do remember from reading some of the essays is that those prime ministers who were in the House of Lords, having never been in the House of Commons, really did suffer in a sense because they hadn't quite got they weren't as in touch with people as maybe MPs in the Commons were. I mean, even in the 18th century, where there were rotten boroughs and all the rest of it, I think there was still this idea that if you were a member of Parliament, you kind of had, you were more in touch with the common people, the plebs, as somebody might put it, than you would be if you're in the House of Lords, understandably so. Yep. And I think the Earl of Chatham, William Pitt the Elder, he suffered because he went into the House of Lords and didn't really, I think that was actually, he, if I remember rightly in the essay on him, that was considered a little bit of a problem for him. And there were several other prime ministers that found it difficult to manage their factions or their parties, in inverted commas, at the times, if they weren't in the House of Commons. So they would have to have a surrogate in the House of Commons, and that often didn't really work very well.
Okay. Now, as I said, I wanted to bring a bit of a free market angle to this. You've explained your algorithm of trying to find fair criteria to build the entire league table and pyramid of all of the prime ministers we've had. But supposing you were looking at it from an IA perspective and you didn't want to be as neutral as you've been on Clem Attlee, you wanted to measure how free market have prime ministers been in the broadest sense. We were touching earlier that might involve liberal reform, emancipation of Catholics, the ending of slavery, the widening of the franchise. So from a kind of free market liberal perspective, this person asks, aside from Thatcher, rather assuming that Thatcher would be number one, might well be queried, who do you think was the United Kingdom's most free market prime minister?
Well, you could make an argument for Gladstone. You could make an argument for John Major. If you think of some of the policies that he invoked in his time, some privatisations, for example, which Margaret Thatcher had shied away from. She didn't do the railways. It was John Major that did. Now, I would argue he did it in entirely the wrong way, mm-hmm. and in a way that wasn't as free market as it could have been. He privatised the ports. I think if you look at it purely from a free market point of view, John Major and Margaret Thatcher would be up there. I think really ever since the Conservative Party was invented in the 1840s, 1850s, there has been this paternalistic streak, which believed that state intervention was very necessary to protect people and encourage the welfare state, that if you, even though there are large parts of the Conservative Party that weren't really resiled to the welfare state until, you could argue, in the past few decades. Mm-hmm. I think there was certainly always this paternalistic streak, which Disraeli certainly had. And you go through, fall through most leaders. So I think it's quite difficult to argue, for example, that Harold Macmillan should qualify as an advocate of huge numbers of free market policies. And I'm struggling to think of any, really, apart from Thatcher and Major, that would.
Heath began as quite a free market approach, but you turned.
But he never believed it. That was the problem. He never believed it.
On a sort of similar theme, one of our attendees says, Ian raises a good point about many prime ministers who would not cut it today. Some argue we will never see another Mrs. Thatcher because the media and social media would stop her radical ideas from getting voted through. Does Ian agree with that view regarding Thatcher? And do you think we'll ever see a prime minister with a radical agenda for change ever again on any side of the political spectrum, I might add? Does the new way in which we select these people, the ordeal of media coverage perhaps that they need to go through, does that encourage a kind of charismatic centrism rather than back in the day, if you were able to articulate a particular philosophy or argument, you might be able to get that radical agenda through? Do you think the way we now arbitrate elections and debates tends to mean that radicalism is less likely to prevail?
I think that's quite difficult to judge. I think a lot does depend on the fact that we have a news media now which is intrinsically liberal in its outlook. I'm not going to say left-wing, but has a liberal view. And I think anybody that is to the right of Tony Blair is considered deeply suspicious and there to be brought down. This idea that we have a right-wing news media, I think, is completely for the birds, but that's a different subject. I think people like conviction, but they also like politicians who are willing to admit when they're wrong, and those two things really don't go hand in hand. I don't see any radical politicians on the scene at the moment. Jeremy Corbyn was certainly one, you could argue. Look what happened to him. Now, I think somebody, a Tony Blair figure who held the views of Jeremy Corbyn, I think would actually be quite dangerous. Because if you think about the 2017 Labour election manifesto, I was appalled at how many people fell for that and thought it was the most wonderful thing they'd ever seen. Perfectly sensible people in many ways. Well, if you'd actually had somebody who could have gone out there and sold it properly, then you have a problem. On the right, I mean, are there really any radicals left anymore apart from maybe Michael Gove? And I mean, Michael Gove is not going to become prime minister for all sorts of different reasons. But I don't see anybody else who is sort of holding the torch of liberal free market thinking in the Conservative Party at the moment. So I doubt whether I will see the day when we have a Conservative Prime Minister who is radical in the way that we all now think of as Margaret Thatcher as being radical, in economic terms at any rate.
Interesting. Now, let me pick one or two questions, and I want to ask you a couple of questions about your other book, which I promised to touch on. Here are a couple of flippant ones. If you were to recast the Prime Ministers in The Crown, who would you pick to play them? Have you watched any of The Crown and thought, oh my God, why didn't they pick such and such a person to play that individual? I haven't watched the new series. It's Gillian Anderson who's playing Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, well, I've watched the first 3 or 4 episodes, and I can't make up my mind about Gillian Anderson. And she's got her mannerisms, she's got that pigeon walk down to a T, she's got the hair down to a T, but her face is the wrong shape, and her voice is so exaggerated and strained that you just sort of wonder whether it really works. I mean, some people think it's a hideous portrayal of Margaret Thatcher. I don't. I do find it weird that some of the scenes that she's in just never happen. I mean, she went for the weekend at Balmoral. Yes, she did go to Balmoral, but they make out the royal family just treated her so appallingly. And this sort of thing never happened. And this is the problem when you have a sort of faction drama, particularly when it's related to modern day events. I'm the sort of person that goes through these things and thinks, well, no, that's wrong. And my partner said, well, the royal family don't have number plates on their cars, so that detail is wrong.
Right.
Do they not have advisors on that? But in terms of people who could play, I'll tell you, the guy who plays Prince Charles in The Crown would be a brilliant Gordon Brown. If anybody was to do a biopic
Gordon Brown,
he would be brilliant at that.
That's a really good thought. And then if all 55 prime ministers, this is the most upvoted one, if all 55 prime ministers were entered in the Hunger Games at their peak of their pomp, who would win, this participant asks.
I'm not familiar hugely with the Hunger Games.
So the Hunger Games is, I haven't watched it, but I understand it's a sort of fight to the death.
Just hang on 1 second. Can you bring your charging thing? Because my computer's about to run out of battery. Sorry, apologies.
No, that's all right. We need to get some electricity to you. So the Hunger Games is a kind of fight to the death, I think, if I understand it correctly. You're sort of all thrown into the arena and only one of you survives.
I think Lloyd George would be quite good in that. Who else?
He was a true survivor, right? Well, I guess
he was a street fighter, and street fighting is quite a good thing for a prime minister to be. And he didn't come from the landed gentry. He came from a very poor background. I think I'd probably pick him.
And then the last one before I want to move on to some thoughts on your other book, is the decline of great prime ministers, although perhaps your league table doesn't suggest that there's been a decline. Some of the greats are in relatively modern era, but is the decline of great prime ministers, this person asked, tied to the emergence of a professional career-focused political class? That back in the day, you do something different, you build a career somewhere, the Duke of Wellington, for example, and you would become prime minister. The question here is it now a political class? I'm hoping we've still got Ian. His battery may have died. Andy Mayer suggests in the chat that maybe Liz Truss is the stakeholder of or the torch bearer of of free market liberalism in the government. Don't know whether she'll emerge as a future prime minister. And then this one, which I'm struggling to answer myself, which I should be able to answer. Ian, you're back. You're
apologies for that. It said at the beginning that it was going to last 2.5 hours.
Never trust what it says on the tin. So the question was whether great prime ministers are now, if you like, less likely or have disappeared altogether because of the emergence of a professional political class. You know, it's now a career choice that you sort of, you can, Heseltine famously wrote everything on the back of his cigarette packet to work out how to become PM. Whereas back in the day, you would have a wider role in public life of some form that might then lead you into politics. Is that a better way of finding great people rather than this sort of factory-produced professional politician?
I think it is partly that, but it's also the fact that we've become youth obsessed. I gave up any parliamentary ambitions when I was 48 because I just thought, well, if you're in your 50s in this country, that is when you ought to be going into politics. If you're in most other countries, if you've had a successful career, that's what you do. Mm-hmm. But in this country, you might as well give up. There are exceptions to the rule, it has to be said, but very, very few. And I think we lose out on an awful lot of people for that reason. And I think there is a feeling that if you're not in Parliament by the time you're 35 or 40, you're not really going to make it in any great shape or form. So I think that's part of the problem. There are too many people from a professional political background in politics, and there isn't a... And you can't have a totally representative sample of the electorate. I mean, I do want a political representatives to be elites. I want them to have had a good education, to have been successful. Mm-hmm. And this idea that you could literally pick 650 people out of the phone book and put them in Parliament and they'd do a better job, it is completely for the birds. And I think it is for political parties to really look at their own selection systems and to work out how they can attract better people. Because if you look at the cabinet and the shadow cabinet at the moment, and I'm going to sound like an old git here, but they are a very, very low quality compared to what we've had before. And I'm sure that there were people in the 1980s who said, oh, you look at Margaret Thatcher's cabinet, it's not like Harold Macmillan. So yeah. I recognise that I'm going to sound like an old git when I say that. But I think there is an element of truth to it at the moment.
Interesting. So that you do think that the quality of the political class is on the decline, and in part because of the kind of the professionalisation of politics, it being a career option rather than public service in the truest sense.
Look at the party leaders. When David Cameron was prime minister, you had him have really never having had a, okay, he worked for Carlton Communications for a few years. That was the extent of his experience outside being a SPAD or having gone to Oxford and Eton. Nick Clegg, he'd worked for the EU, but do people really regard that as a proper job? Ed Miliband had been an advisor all of his adult life. George Osborne, I mean, you could go on. It's a little bit different now, but I mean, Boris Johnson, he was a journalist. Okay, I'm not saying journalists should never become politicians for obvious reasons, but what was his record of achievement? Theresa May, I mean, she worked for the Bank of England for a time, I think. She was a local councillor for a time. Gordon Brown was more or less straight into politics. Tony Blair had been a lawyer. I mean, you go back and there isn't a huge record of achievement prior to politics.
Howard Wilson, Jim Callaghan. Who was the last successful businessman or woman who sort of made it, not necessarily to the top? I'm trying to think.
Stanley Baldwin.
Or who was the chap from, he didn't quite make it to the top, what was his name? The guy who was the chief executive of ASDA. I think he went
Archie Norman.
I mean, he had
John Davies, he was a cabinet minister under Ted Heath. He'd been head of the CBI. He sank without trace. People who come into politics directly from the world of business often don't do very well, it has to be said. But as I say, the only prime minister I can really think of would be Stanley Baldwin, who had been a businessman.
Interesting. Look, our hour's nearly up, Ian. I'm just going to remind people, we'll put the link again in the chat, and it will be on the show notes in YouTube if you're watching after the event. You persuaded me to fork out £17.39 for the hardcover on Amazon. As I say, I need lots of reading material.
No, don't buy it on Amazon. Buy it from your local bookshop.
Oh, buy it from your local bookshop. I'm sorry. £17.39 to help the retail sector bounce back.
I'm really torn on this because, in a way, I want the book to get as high up the Amazon chart as it can. And it did get up to 49, believe it or not, the other day. Okay. But you look at the plight that local bookshops are in at the moment. I mean, as if they haven't got enough to contend with Amazon stealing their business, they aren't even allowed to open at the moment. So, but a lot of them do sell online. So it might cost you a few pounds extra, but you'd be doing wonders for your local community.
Well, we're a very free market people here, so make sure you buy it. But the actual supplier you buy it from is an open decision for you in a competitive market with different benefits and costs. But let me just have a few words from you in on your other book, because this is I have already purchased but have not yet read. Why Can't We All Get Along? And it what's the problem you're trying to solve here? I mean, from my perspective, it might just be because I'm the head of the IEA and that's a controversial role, but I'm trying to be objective about it. It does seem to me that political debate over the course of our lifetimes has got a lot more poisonous in the past 10 years. There isn't respect for other people's views if you're reaching across the aisle. There's an increasing tendency to assume that anyone who disagrees with you is insincere or corrupt rather than just of a different philosophical viewpoint. Why can't we all get along was the question you were asking. What's the problem you were trying to solve in this book?
Well, it is all about the decline in public discourse. The subtitle of the book is Shout Less, Listen More. And it sounds a little bit motherhood and apple pie, and to a certain extent it is, I suppose. But those of us who inhabit Twitter have seen the decline in discourse, particularly on there. Now, the internet has been great in terms of providing ordinary people with a voice. In 1995, no one had a voice apart from being able to sound off in their local newspaper every now and again. Then came blogs, and they democratized the media in some ways. Then the mainstream media really launched a takeover bid on blogs. So blogging became something that you did for another institution. There are still independent blogs, but they're few and far between. And that it was also overtaken by Twitter. And Twitter is so spontaneous, and that's the joy of it, but it's also, there are huge downsides, because you can get into really vicious arguments with people just because someone says something bad about you and you think, well, I'm not going to let them get away with that. So you say something even worse back, and before you know, you've created a real enemy. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of thing. Whereas I have always really enjoyed Twitter up until the last couple of years, where I found it, I mean, if I wasn't doing the kind of thing that I do, I probably wouldn't actually contribute to it anymore, because I think it has become an absolute sewer in many ways.
Yeah.
So I've tried to analyze why this has happened. And look, we've always had robust debate in this country. We've never been shrinking violets, but there is a difference between robust debate and just insulting debate. And I came to the realization that I was part of the problem, and that I would react far too quickly. And if someone called me a twat, I'd call them an effing twat. And it just got to the point where I thought, what are you doing? This is ridiculous. And so I've tried to come up with a few suggestions at the end of the book as to how we can all debate with each other a little bit better. And I mean, the book's had a reasonable, it's a slightly awkward mix of, it's not an autobiography, but there are autobiographical bits in it. And I've tried to use examples from my own experience, my own life in politics and the media, to illustrate the kind of things that I'm talking about. And the last third of the book is all about different issues, where the debate about immigration, for example, or benefits, has been corrupted by language in many ways. And there are some subjects, I mean, trans issues, for example, I will not dip my toe into that any longer, because I know what I'm, the reward, if that's the right word, that I'm going to reap if I do. Mm-hmm. And I'm not anti-trans at all, but I think what's happened to J.K. Rowling has been an absolute travesty, where she said something completely innocent is now being, I mean, you had people refusing to appear on the Graham Norton show last week because she was going to be a guest as well.
Yeah, this is madness.
What has the world come to? So
what's the remedy? What's the remedy? Is it just we all need to be more conscious of this, not use the F word as much on Twitter, display some self-denying ordinance? What's the Ian Dale roadmap to a more civilized public discourse, the one we've had over the last hour?
Partly all of those things. And I've got 50 different ways of improving discourse at the end of the book. And I won't go through all of them now, don't worry. But it is partly taking time out before you react to somebody that has insulted you. And I'll give you one example of where this worked. About a month or so ago, somebody was listening to my radio show and just said, Ian Dale is a Tory stooge. He's so far up Boris Johnson's arse, you can't see his shoes. Now, 2 years ago, I would have probably reacted fairly angrily to that. So all I did was I just replied saying, this is not true. Here are 9 occasions over the last fortnight where I've criticised the government or Boris Johnson, then just listed them. And he came back for afters a bit. And then the next day he DM'd me and said, look, I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have said that. I can see now that you do have an independent mind, blah, blah, blah. And we've actually become quite good friends as a result. We've never met, but we've sort of built a sort of online friendship bizarrely. I'm thinking, well, that is a really good example of where you can sort of rescue victory from the jaws of defeat.
So pause and think, you know, engage brain before you engage keyboard. Yeah.
I mean, it's not particularly earth shattering to say that, but I think it's something I've had a lot of people who've read the book contact me and say, you know what, I've actually sat down and thought to myself, my conduct is not good enough and I'm going to change it. Well, that's all I can hope to achieve.
Great. Well, Ian, thank you for not just over the last hour giving us a run through of all 55 British prime ministers, their strengths and weaknesses and where things might go in the future, but also saving public discourse from the sewer. I mean, these are enormous contributions to to public debate. It's been an absolute pleasure having you, on IEA London, Ian, for this book club event. Just a reminder, if you're watching us on YouTube and you'd like to join these discussions in future on Zoom, where you can put questions to our panelists, please go to the IEA website, iea.org.uk.
Thanks for listening. As Mark said at the end of the recording, if you would like to join the IEA Book Club, you can find out how to do so on our website, iea.org.uk. You can also watch all of our upcoming book club events on the IEA YouTube channel, IEA London.